Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I am Gail Seiler, and I'm your host for today. And I want to say thank you for listening to the show. Yesterday was KHOI's birthday party. We are 6 years old here at KHOI. Been on the air 6 years. And many of our listeners came to the station yesterday to celebrate. There was great entertainment, fun activities like silk screening, and delicious birthday cake, along with other snacks. I think everyone who was able to be there had a great time. So thanks to everyone who came down to celebrate KHOI's 6 years on the air. And thanks also to the organizers of the events and all the volunteers who helped to make it happen. And it was great weather for the birthday party yesterday. A little warm, but it actually was quite nice, and really the whole weekend was nice. So let's see what the weather for the upcoming week will be. Today will be warm and humid. The temperature will be as high as 88, but it will feel like 102 with the high humidity. And it will be sunny, so today will be a hot one. On Tuesday, there is a risk of thunderstorms with a high of 84 and a heat index just below 100. Wednesday through Sunday will bring us partly cloudy weather with some showers on most of those days. The high temperature each day will be around 81 or 82 with showers straight through next weekend, and it will be rather humid all week. But it's August, so I guess we should expect that humidity. But the good news is that nighttime temperatures will be in the 60s, so we'll have a little cooling each night. That's the weather for the coming week, while many Iowans will be going to the state fair, so it looks to be pretty good weather for that. Dennis, you're here to share with us the important news stories related to the state of Iowa.
And that includes the Iowa State Fair. We'll get to that in just a moment. Hello, everyone. There was plenty of news around Iowa last week, much of it involving the ongoing hunt for 20-year-old Molly Tibbetts, the University of Iowa student who vanished more than 3 weeks ago. Last Monday, Molly's dad told a TV reporter that he thought she had been caught in what he called some kind of misunderstanding with someone she knows. Rob Tibbetts said he believes that no one went into the house where she was staying in Brooklyn, Iowa, to hurt her, and that he thinks she left willingly. And the brother of Molly Tibbetts' boyfriend said there were no signs of a struggle at the house where she had been staying. Molly Tibbetts disappeared July 18th while she was dog-sitting for her boyfriend and his brother in Brooklyn. Her disappearance has gained, as you know, national attention. As many as 40 investigators have been working the case each day, and they've tracked down hundreds of tips that resulted in ground, air, and water searches. Last Monday, the FBI asked a farmer who has spoken with investigators numerous times about Molly to take a lie detector test. At first, Wayne Cheney said no, adding in his words, "I don't need to. It's stupid." But later in the week, he took the test. Cheney said he'd never met Tibbetts or her family. Meanwhile, police in Marion, Iowa, said a woman who called to report seeing Molly at a local Casey's General Store was wrong. That call came in last Wednesday morning. A nearby officer went to the store, looked at its surveillance footage, and determined it was not Molly. More than $300,000 have been raised as a reward for information that helps in Molly Tibbetts' safe return. Anyone with information is urged to call Crime Stoppers at 800-452-1111. Here's that number again, 800-452-1111. Also last week, in the community of Jefferson, a judge sentenced an Iowa father to 75 years in prison for sexually assaulting his own daughter, who died months later in a house fire that authorities believe was intentionally set. 47-year-old James Hubert Exline Jr. must also register for life as a sex offender. Another story reported that the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights will continue to monitor the University of Iowa's athletics program for gender equity concerns raised by female athletes 3 years ago. The office sent a letter to the university back in July saying it determined that it's necessary to follow up with coaches and student athletes this fall about equal treatment in equipment and supplies. Three of the 13 categories included in that 2015 complaint filed by four field hockey players. There was much more last week, including word on Tuesday that the federal government plans to build a new courthouse at the former site of the downtown Des Moines Riverfront YMCA. That courthouse would have 230,000 square feet and cost $137 million. The Hubble Realty Company owns that site and just last Monday released plans to build a $75 million luxury condominium on that same land. The government will have to buy the land from Hubble or get it through eminent domain. Meanwhile, still in Des Moines, a water main on 4th Street that broke a couple of weekends ago, just as the city's downtown farmer's market was ending, broke again last Tuesday morning as crews were trying to make repairs. The new break did not affect traffic because the road was already closed for repairs. Waterworks Chief Bill Stowe said it was the age of Des Moines' infrastructure, which is more than a century old, that caused the original break. Much of the city's cast iron piping system needs to be replaced, but budget constraints have stopped that from taking place. And there was word that the Polk County Conservation Board voted in favor of negotiating an agreement with the city of Des Moines that could include a contribution of up to $1 million for flood relief. That money would be used to buy properties damaged by this year's severe flooding in Des Moines. The city has already pledged more than $11 million to buy homes damaged by that flooding. Also last week, voters in Warren County overwhelmingly said yes to spending nearly $30 million for a new courthouse and jail. The plan needed at least 60% plus one vote to pass. It received 69%. The new building will be constructed on the square in Indianola. It will have 80,000 square feet, which is 50,000 square feet more than the county's current courthouse and jail. There was much more last week, of course, including word that Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley told Audubon residents during a town hall meeting that he and other state leaders have President Trump's ear when it comes to trade matters. But he said it remains to be seen whether they can have any effect on the president's trade policies. One farmer told Grassley, "We do not want federal aid, we want trade." That was in reference to the $12 billion aid package to farmers that the president has proposed. Also last week, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds released her tax returns for the past 10 years. They showed that she and her husband earned $163,000 last year and paid $28,000 of it in taxes. They also donated $17,000 to charity. The couple's effective federal tax rate last year was 18%. By comparison, former Governor Terry Branstad's tax rate was 10% in 2016. Reynolds is seeking election to her first term as governor this November. She called upon her Democratic Party challenger, Fred Hubble, to also release a decade's worth of his tax returns. Also last week, Governor Reynolds dropped an outspoken Medicaid advisor who had repeatedly voiced concerns about how private management companies were treating Iowans who have disabilities. David Hudson had spent 2 years as co-chair of the state's Medical Assistance Advisory Council, whose duties include monitoring Iowa's shift to private management of its $5 billion Medicaid program. Iowa's Supreme Court made news last week when it halted some provisions of the state's new identity verification requirements for voters who cast absentee ballots, but let stand a change that reduced the number of days early voting could take place from 40 to 29 days for this November's general election. The court decided that state election officials cannot enforce signature matching requirements for absentee ballots, and they cannot require voters to include an identification number on absentee ballot request forms. Also last week, the lawyer for adult film star Stormy Daniels, who is suing President Trump, came to Iowa on Friday night and urged Democrats to abandon niceties and to, in his words, fight fire with fire. Michael Avenatti appeared at a fundraiser in Clear Lake. He says he is actively considering whether to run for president. He told a crowd that Democrats need to fight back against the Trump administration, saying, in his words, "We can no longer be the party that turns the other cheek." He said he supports Medicare for All, ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, and what he called sensible gun control. He spoke alongside two declared presidential candidates, Congressman John Delaney of Maryland and businessman Andrew Yang, as well as a potential candidate, Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio. Delaney said, in his words, "We should be the party that brings people together in a new and exciting coalition." Ryan called on Democrats to, in his words, be bold. Yang proposed giving every American adult $1,000 a month, no questions asked. Of course, a lot of last week's news was about the opening of the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines. The fair runs through this coming weekend, and as usual, there were lots of booths with fair food of all types, plenty of entertainment, and hordes of people. One of the most poignant stories at this year's fair involves Jada Smith. She is the daughter of longtime fair concessionaires Bobby and Marilyn Bluer, who were murdered in their camper at the fair in 1996. Turned out their killings were part of a plot involving the Bluer's older daughter Jamie, her husband, and another man. All three are now serving life sentences. This is the first year the Bluer's other daughter, Jada Smith, is back at the fair since her parents' deaths. And yes, she is carrying on their tradition. She has a concession stand of her own called Jada's Concessions, where she is selling funnel cakes, just like her parents did decades ago. The Des Moines Register reports that much of the talk at the fair these days is about the state's official problem with trade wars that have broken out after President Trump's tough talk about tariffs and his imposition of them against foreign countries. Those tariffs and counter-tariffs have slammed Iowa, which, of course, is a national leader in the production of pork, soybeans, corn, eggs, beef, and milk. Corn prices are now down about 15% since May. Pork is down about 30%. Of course, entertainment, big part of the fair. Friday night's performer is considered royalty. Country music icon Reba McEntire told the crowd at the grandstand that it was good to be back in Iowa. And as she put it, thank you all for inviting us back to the fair. She's been there numerous times before, seven times since 1989, and a Friday's standing room only grandstand crowd of more than 14,000 is any indication. That's just how Iowans like it. One more note from the state fair. The results of the hot dog eating contest held on Saturday. The winner, Matt Hazard, whose nickname, believe it or not, is Hungry, and for good reason. Hungry Hazard, who is from Normal, Illinois, but whose appetite is anything but normal, managed to down 29 and a half hot dogs in 10 minutes. And consider this, he only got into competitive eating last year during his first visit to the fair. He'd never done it before. By virtue of winning on Saturday, Hungry Hazard earned a spot at the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest at Coney Island next July 4th. And he's going to have to compete against this year's winner of that contest, Joey Chestnut, who downed 74. Yes, 74 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. So, Hungry, you still got a long way to go. Good luck. And that, Gail, is your summary of news and hot dogs from around Iowa this past week. I'm going to be back here on Wednesday with news from the front pages of several weekly papers from around Ames. You know, I went to the fair on Friday, and I have to admit, I could only down one Nathan's hot dog. But in my defense, that was right before I had two pork chops on a stick.
Two?
Two of them. First time I'd ever had a pork chop on a stick, and I liked it so much, I said, let's do it again. I came back heavy-hearted and heavy-bodied.
And heavy.
Yes, I
heavy,
did.
Just heavy.
Yes, I did.
I've seen those. Isn't it hard to eat it on a stick?
You've never had one, have
you? Do you have to use your fingers?
Yeah. It's literally, the stick is part of the bone that's been cut away. The meat's been cut away, and you hold it up, and it's really a big pork chop. But they're delightful. I've never had one, and I highly recommend it.
So you had two to make up for lost time.
I haven't eaten since then. It's been since Friday.
Okay. Thanks, Dennis, for keeping us informed about all of that. And you also have another interesting interview that you did for us this week.
Well, Keith Morgan, who is, as you know, the Story County Emergency Management Coordinator, dropped by our studios last Friday, and boy, did we have plenty to talk about then. Keith, it has been a busy summer in terms of rain and flooding, tornadoes, even a train derailment in northern Iowa. Describe what's happened this summer and the challenges all that has posed.
Well, as you described, we've had a lot of what you would consider to be almost small events, but the collective effect on them has been quite a bit across the entire state. As you indicated, we started off around here up by Mason City. They had some flash flooding that occurred at the beginning of June, which was followed by flash flooding down here in the Ames area and the Kelly area, which created a problem in Kelly. We had standing water in Kelly for well over a week just because of the hydrology around there. And we worked with Homeland Security to try and get some resources to get that pumped out. As soon as we thought we had that all taken care of, we had another round of rain that caused the flash flooding down in Ankeny, which got a lot of the publicity. But we also had the same kind of activities happening in Collins and Maxwell. That was followed by tornadoes that occurred in Marshalltown, in Pella, and also down in Bondurant, which gives you a wide spectrum of the natural disasters that can happen. But in our line of work, we also look at some of the knock-on effects or the cascading effects. And up in northwest Iowa, the heavy rains had created problems with one of the rail systems, which created a derailment that caused a leak of oil that got into a river system that feeds even further on down into the Missouri River. So there we transition from natural disasters cascading into man-made disasters that have a wide, wide-ranging effects on it. So it demonstrates that we need to have a system that can react from everything from a tornado that happens quickly, and you have to activate your systems to respond to that within minutes, to flash flooding, which took a few hours, to potentially the Skunk River flooding, which we can see coming 12 hours down, to something like a hazardous material situation, which may actually take hearing that they're still working on the cleanup from that, and that occurred about mid-June. So 6 weeks later, they're still working to contain any of the contaminants and get them properly disposed of. So all the way from short, quick reaction to the long term. And then the real long term is, how do you put a community back together again? You look at Marshalltown, that has the double impact of really triple impact of the county courthouse being severely damaged, and now they've got all of those capabilities are dispersed out across the town. The residents, their housing has been affected, and right now we know it's a tight housing market to begin with, and people to companies to be able to come in and help repair those houses are going to be hard to find. Plus, the Lennox factory has got to be repaired to bring that community back to a whole community. So it's these events that have happened over the last 6 weeks are going to have long-term impacts for months, weeks, months, and years.
Do we have adequate systems in place to handle all of this?
I will never say we have adequate systems in place, in that we always plan. When we're planning, we look at what is the likelihood of an event happening and what is the impact of it. And somewhere along the line, you have to accept some risk. For instance, using an extreme case, what happened over in Japan. If I was to go to folks and say, we need to plan to be able to withstand a 10.0 earthquake that's going to be followed by a 30-foot tsunami that's going to knock out a nuclear power plant, people would laugh at me, and they would say, we can't afford to have all of those resources. It's not very likely to happen. But it can happen. So there, we are always going to have to take risks, because some resources that I would like to make us even more prepared are going to have to come from somewhere. And there may be another use that our political leadership is going to say, that's more important. It's happening right now. So, but what we do try and do is optimize what we have. And that's where emergency management comes in. Every town, to be totally prepared, would have absolutely everything they need right at their disposal, but we can't afford that. So we coordinate, we look at capabilities, and we try and make it so that within the time frame that we're going to need it, we have at least one of those within the county. It may be a pump that's up in Story City that I can transport on down to someplace else and take care of that, as opposed to each city having a large, what we call trash pump to move water. It's the same. We are getting a command and control trailer, and that we're going to share amongst any community that might need it should there be a disaster, as opposed to each community having their own mobile command and control facility. So that's where we look at the capabilities that we think we might need, and we try and find the best way to fill that. And again, there are times that you have to accept risk.
With all that happened this summer, thousands of people were impacted by the flooding, by the tornadoes, by that train derailment. We always talk about getting people to prepare. How do you get people to prepare for something that may never have happened to them, or that they think is never going to happen to them?
Well, first off, these are actually teachable moments. Many people, we haven't had an outbreak of tornadoes in a long time. And also, all the tornadoes that have hit have been quite a ways away from us here in Story County. Well, I'm sure everybody has watched and seen what goes on down in Bondurant in Marshalltown, probably knows somebody. So now there's a direct connection to them of that this is a real risk. And then my office goes out and we try and talk to both businesses, people, to let them know what they can do. And one of the most important things that people can do is have adequate insurance. Because everybody, a lot of people have this thought that FEMA will come in and they'll be bringing in their individual assistance program. Well, over the past since 2011, we've had 15 presidential disaster declarations here in the state of Iowa. And people think, well, that's good. Then we get that kind of assistance. But the answer is no. We've only had individual assistance going to families and individuals in one of those 15 disasters. Most of those the other 14, all of the aid and assistance went to governments to be able to take care of the damages that occurred. So you don't have to have enough you don't need to pay for insurance to take you back up maybe to where you were before, but have enough insurance to get your life going again. Get a roof over your head, get clothes and things like that. And that insurance also has to cover flooding. People are forced, if they're going to get any sort of a mortgage that is backed by the federal government, if they're in a flood zone, they have to get flood insurance. But you can get flood insurance even if you're not in one of those flood zones. And we've seen an awful lot more. The flooding that has occurred here in Story County has been flash flooding, over-the-surface flooding that has gone in through windows, you know, these escape windows and stuff like that, into the basement. Or another kind of insurance that you'd have to talk to your insurer is if it were to come up through your sanitary sewer system. I'm realistic that it costs money, but when it comes down to it, you either need to save up a whole bunch of money to be able to take care of that, or you need to invest in insurance. And these are choices that individuals get to make.
From your experience, do most people have adequate insurance?
No. They don't have adequate insurance, and they haven't updated their insurance. There's a lot of other stuff. Really sit down with your agent and talk through something beyond a fire. For instance, they may have insurance that will rebuild the house, but it doesn't have the insurance to, if the structure is unsafe, to knock down the old house, to remove the debris from the property, and then rebuild the house. Again, you don't have to have all that kind of insurance, but think through all of these and either save up the money to be able to do it or have insurance to reduce that risk to you.
In addition to insurance, what can people do? What should they buy? What should they have on hand to be ready in case something happens?
The first thing is, and I say this over and over again, but that annoying weather radio, that one that goes off and wakes you up in the middle of the night with that loud alert tone is probably the most important thing, because when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you have your cell phone turned off, that 10 minutes notification that there's a tornado coming, and tornadoes happen all through the day, could be the thing that protects the thing that's most important to you and I, that's yourself and your family. After that, have a plan. Where are you going to go? Where's the safest place for you to go inside of your home or your apartment building should there be straight line winds or a tornado that's pretty significant? Think about flooding. What do I need to do if I have flooding or if there's a lot of water? How will I get away from my facility to someplace that's safer as you're going? I have a weather radio that is solar powered. I leave it in a windowsill so that I know that it's got both the radio and it's got an LED flashlight so that I can be able to see and hear what's going on. That takes me through the first few minutes. Know how to turn off the natural gas and the water and the electricity in your home should they be damaged, and should there be risk for further damage if you don't turn those off. Have a little bit of, we say, have 1 gallon of water per person for up to 3 days. Ames has experienced a loss of its water system. Have that so that you can take care of yourself for those first 3 days. A food supply. Have, again, food for 3 days, and make sure that you rotate it on out. Have a picnic with your survival food once a year so that you rotate it out and you have other stuff that's in there. Have a plan to communicate. What if you and your family are scattered out across the town and something happens? How are you going to let each other know where you're at and that you're safe? We have a lot of data on our website, www.storycountyiowa.gov. Go to emergency management. We've got links that have entire lists. Think about your pets. How are you going to take care of your pets? Do you have prescriptions? Do you have an extra set of glasses maybe someplace that's stored so that in the middle of the night when you've lost everything else, you at least have shoes on and you've got glasses and prescriptions to get you through the first 3 days?
All of this seems common sense, but at the same time, it takes work. It takes preparation. Again, from your experience, are most people prepared?
No, they haven't run through this. Every March we have National Severe Weather Awareness Week. Once a year, run through that plan and know what is going to happen. When we have these kind of events, think back to yourself, what have I got that will get me through those first 3 days? And it always seems like it's going to be somebody else, but unfortunately, we've seen it that it can happen here.
You mentioned going to a safe place in your house if a tornado hits. If those warnings go off, and I hope they never will, but they will, if they go off, where is the safest place that a person can go in his or her house?
The first thing is to try and get as low as possible in your house. Basement, obviously, is the best place to go. Then when you're in a place like that, try and find something pretty sturdy to go to get under, even if you are down below ground, in case things should fall in from above you. If you can't get to a basement, go as far inside of the building as you possibly can and away from glass. So interior bathrooms are usually a pretty good place that you can go to. Even if it's a closet or something like that, get away from those exterior walls where the debris will come through those windows and injure you. If you're in an apartment building, we have a lot of apartment buildings that the first floor is commercial buildings. So think to yourself, where am I going to go in this apartment building that is as low as possible, that is as far away from glass as possible?
What about if you're on the road in a car and a tornado warning goes off, or you see it and you're right near it? What should you do?
They are actually changing their philosophy on this. Originally, it was get out of the car, go lay as flat in an area that's flat. One thing we tell people to definitely not do is don't go and try and ride it out under an underpass, because those become wind tunnels that become very dangerous. So there are still two philosophies. The one is get out. The other one is just strap yourself into the car, and the car itself will provide some of the protection that you need. You'll definitely lose the glass in the car, but the frame around it, if you are picked up and tossed around, can provide protection. So there's those two philosophies. Definitely, be aware of your surroundings. Obviously, if you see bad weather up ahead, try and divert around it. I was coming down from Minnesota and could see the dark clouds in the distance. And I was driving. I had my wife get on the weather radio or the weather radar that's available now on smartphones, and we were able to divert around it. So we have a lot of technology now. Use it. Keep yourself aware. Keep yourself informed. And that's probably the best thing. Think ahead. What would I do if this happened?
With all that's happened this summer, with all the rain, the flooding, the tornadoes, what lessons should we have taken from all of these?
The lessons in my world, a lot of what it is how would we react? How would we mobilize the governmental resources? We in Story County have what we call a warm emergency operations center. We have computers set up and they're ready to go at any time. And fortunately, the board of supervisors from Story County have allowed me to train up their staff to provide that command and control. And as a matter of fact, we just did some training at the beginning of this week with those people so that we could react, get that information in, and try and mobilize resources. Another part for this is we have to be good at the first things is figuring out what the damages are, figuring out what we're going to do with volunteers, and figuring out what are we going to do with the debris. And those last two are because Iowans are absolutely fantastic about taking care of themselves. They will show up in large numbers to volunteer, and they'll move their debris out to the side of the roads. But then we have to get it appropriately disposed of, and there are processes we can do to make that much easier and cheaper. So that's one of the things we're looking at, to see how we can get better at doing that kind of activities.
Is it also important to have people understand that in the immediate aftermath of any kind of emergency, nobody from government may be there to help them for a period of time? It may be an isolation period for just a bit of time there.
And that's what that 72 hours is. I really would think that we would never get to 72 hours. I would say it would be within minutes or hours that we would get people there. But depending on the size and the scale of it, it may be actually longer. So that's where a personal plan comes in, having those resources to be able to take your care of yourself. The other thing is access information. Find out what we do want you to do so that you can be a part of the response, an additive part to the response instead of a hindrance to the response.
So every time we have something, you and your agency learn something, don't you?
Every time. And we also look at what has happened in other counties so that we can learn from what they were doing. We actually went down and assisted Polk County after theirs because they need a little bit of extra staffing, and also because we can observe what's going on there, take those lessons and integrate them so that we're better at what we need to do up here.
If there was one thing that somebody listening to this could take away from our interview, one thing you would have them do that perhaps they're not doing right now, one thing to prepare for an emergency, what would that be?
Get out your insurance, look at it, talk to your insurance agent, make sure that you have adequate coverage to get your life going again. It may not get you back to 100%, but make sure that you can take care of yourself, because there aren't other programs out there really to do that for you.
Anything else you'd like to tell us today?
We've got some great volunteers also out there. We just had a segment here on KHOI about our amateur radio folks, which are right now working with Ames to be better at assisting them. We've got a retired senior and volunteer program. That all of those things are important because, again, we've got to take care of ourselves. And if you'd like to, contact us and we can hook you up with a volunteer organization to help out in disasters.
Is there anything else that folks can get if they do contact you? What types of information could they receive from your agency?
We have checklists to make sure that you've got everything that you need should there be a disaster, checklists to take care of your pets, checklists to take care of maybe you have elderly residents. Get on our mass notification system. It's called Story County Iowa Alerts. The sign up for that is on our website. If you have problems with it, give us a call and we'll help you get linked into that, because that's one of the ways we're going to give you the information you need to take care of yourself.
I signed up for your emergency alerts just this past week, and it is easy to do so online.
Right. And we don't have weather alerts come across that. We do that because there are other avenues, and the way those come out could be too repetitive. We save that system for when we really need to talk to you during a disaster.
And your website location is?
Story County, Iowa, all spelled out, all one word, .gov. And then look for emergency management.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. That was Dennis Hart speaking with Keith Morgan from the Story County Emergency Management. That was This Must Be the Place by the Talking Heads. I was looking for a song to play in today's show, and I asked my daughter what she might suggest, and that was her suggestion. So she said it was a song that was stuck in her head this past weekend. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. You probably recognize that sound of a mosquito buzzing. It's summer, and it's a sound we're all familiar with and often annoyed by. We wanted to find out the status of mosquitoes and the diseases they transmit here in Iowa this summer, so I spoke with Dr. Ryan Smith from the Entomology Department at ISU. I understand that your area of specialization is medical entomology, so maybe you can explain what that field is.
Sure. Medical entomology is just kind of the general word that is coined to describe any insects that are able to transmit disease. And so I think most commonly that is thought of as mosquitoes, but this also applies to ticks and several other types of insects that can actually transmit disease throughout the world.
So first, let's get some mosquito basics for Iowa. How many kinds of mosquitoes are there in Iowa?
There is actually close to about 50 different types of mosquitoes that have been found here, about 50 different species. Some of these are going to be found in much, much higher numbers than others. Some of them you'll never see. Some of them have a very strong preference for feeding on other types of mammals. Some of them have very strong human preferences. Well, others don't even feed on blood at all. They actually will feed on just sugar from nectar provided from flowers and other such things.
So
we
not
really have a huge diversity of species here.
Of the mosquitoes that we do have here in Iowa, what's the situation with diseases? Some of them carry West Nile virus and other diseases?
Obviously, of these 50, not all of these are even able to transmit disease. And at least the most prevalent or predominant one here in the state is still West Nile. Of those 50 mosquitoes or so, there's maybe only about 5 or 6 species that we typically will even see that can become infected with West Nile, and really even fewer than that that are really implicated in the transmission of West Nile to humans. So, even though we have this huge diversity of mosquitoes, there's really only a handful that are really actually important from our kind of regular day-to-day and in transmitting disease.
And are there other diseases that mosquitoes can transmit in Iowa other than West Nile virus? For example, we hear a lot about Zika in the news, or we did last year.
Sure. Well, I mean, frankly, with Zika virus, you need a couple different things in order to actually have disease transmission. You need mosquitoes that can actually transmit that disease. And you need what we refer to as a reservoir, or a way to acquire a specific pathogen. And for something like Zika, that requires humans to kind of serve as this way to acquire a disease. And so if a mosquito would have to bite and feed on a number of humans that had Zika virus, and although Iowa did have few cases of people kind of coming back from travel-related illness, going to these kind of Caribbean countries that are nice and warm in the winter, some of these people brought back Zika. But since the numbers were very small, and the mosquitoes that could potentially transmit that disease are so few, the likelihood that you had any kind of Zika transmission in Iowa would be extremely rare or minimal. And that's kind of in contrast to places like Florida, which actually did have transmission, where they have, a huge number of people coming to and from the state that would potentially acquire Zika. They have these mosquitoes there mm-hmm. already. And so it kind of is much more primed for potential transmission of a disease like Zika. In Iowa, really the only real mosquito-borne disease of concern at this point still remains West Nile.
As I understand it, only female mosquitoes bite. Is that true of all these different kinds of mosquitoes that do bite?
Yeah, no, that is correct. Only the female mosquito will actually feed on humans. And the reason why they do this is to they use the blood that they get from biting us to produce eggs. Whereas the male mosquitoes will just feed on nectar to provide nutrients and energy. And usually the males don't last very long, but the females can last for several weeks, even months maybe. And that allows them, by feeding multiple times to actually acquire and then transmit a disease. They're able to really kind of process the blood and use the kind of the nutrients and energy from the blood in order to convert that into proteins that are used for the egg. And, you know, from a single feed, mosquitoes can produce anywhere between like 50 to 100 eggs. And so they can really amplify their numbers rather quickly.
And when they bite us, they're piercing our skin with what kind of structure?
They have kind of a needle-like mouthpart, so it actually kind of resembles a hypodermic needle, and that allows them to, in most cases, evade even the detection of us knowing that they're feeding on us until likely it's too late. And so this kind of very precise needle-like structure will allow them to kind of take up the feed or to take up the blood, and they're usually done feeding within just a few minutes.
Is it true that they release some kind of anesthetic material into our skin so that we don't feel them, or is that not true?
Well, mosquitoes, when they actually do feed on us, they use saliva. So just like you and I, when we're hungry, we salivate. And mosquitoes are kind of the same, and so they actually use this saliva or components of this saliva to actually help them blood feed. And so to some extent, there's components that will enrich blood flow or kind of prevent coagulation or kind of behave as a bit of an anesthetic in and around that area so that we don't sense them biting us. And so the saliva is actually kind of a really neat aspect of their biology.
So they're biting us not just to be annoying, as humans often think. They're just mean mosquitoes, and they're actually quite elaborately adapted to it.
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, they're definitely a nuisance to us, but, I mean, you know, they've actually evolved this ability to take a blood meal, and that provides them with a really nutritious source of energy and protein to produce eggs.
Tell us a little more about the whole life cycle. We always hear that standing water is one of the problems with creating a lot of mosquitoes. What role does standing water play, and what else about their life cycle can you tell us?
Sure. So mosquitoes kind of have a unique life cycle from the perspective that their immature stages are in the water, and their adult stages are, you know, the mosquitoes that we kind of know to hate that are flying around. And so they will only breed in standing water. So they you'll never find any mosquitoes in a stream or anything that's moving. It has to be stagnant.
Still water.
Yeah, still mm-hmm. water. And so that can be water in a bucket that's around the home, or just kind of a small pool of water in a field or, you know, next to the road. And kind of depending on the specific mosquito species, they may have specific preferences for these different habitats. Some of them may associate closer in and around people. Others prefer kind of those more rural potential areas that they can use to breed. But really this kind of consistent theme of this stagnant water allows them to lay their eggs, and the larvae will kind of emerge from the eggs and develop, and they look like little kind of tadpoles to some extent for about the first week and a half. Little kind of wiggly worms, and after they've developed, they will kind of pupate and emerge into adults. And so it takes them about a week and a half to get to that point, maybe a little bit quicker depending on the temperature and nutrition. And then as adults, the males usually don't live very long, but the females can actually live several weeks, and that's really, you know, kind of their ability to bite the real nuisance.
So what has the mosquito season been like so far in Iowa in terms of, have there been a lot of mosquitoes, more than usual, less than usual?
Frankly, this year's kind of been up and down. Like most years, we usually have a real strong peak of mosquito activity. And this year, we've actually had two very strong points, especially here in central Iowa, where typically the predominant species that we see in the state it's called Aedes vexans, and this is a nuisance mosquito. It'll bite you kind of during the day or dusk, and can be found in really high numbers. And they typically come out in these high numbers following big rains. And if you remember, kind of back in May, and then kind of late in July, or early July, we had some big rainstorms that kind of came through this area. And with all the flooding, kind of caused all of these mosquito populations to emerge at really high numbers. And so we have kind of limited surveillance kind of throughout the state. But with what we've seen, the numbers are already on track to, they've already surpassed our numbers from last year. Will probably be a pretty strong season overall. And so we've seen these two really big peaks of mosquito activity. And kind of between that, we haven't had much rain. And, you know, they really need this water. And so these periods of drought have actually really kind of cut down on their numbers, I think, here as of late.
And what about the prevalence of diseases, particularly West Nile virus? Have there been a number of cases this summer or not so many?
To my knowledge, to date, there have been so far two human cases and actually one death. And
in Iowa.
In Iowa. And this kind of just both happened this last week, or they were reported this last week. Kind of right now, as we are in August and getting into early September, this is the peak of West Nile virus transmission. And so kind of year in and year out, we always have, you know, a handful of cases, whether that be single digits or getting into 30 or 40 cases. It's kind of hard to say how this year will shape up. Some of the signs would kind of point to maybe this not being a huge year for West Nile, which is good. But, you know, so far we've seen activity in mosquito populations in five out of the six counties that we are actively doing surveillance in. And kind of year in and year out, we will see the virus in these mosquito populations. So it's always a constant reminder that the virus is out there and that you can potentially have transmission during these peak periods of activity.
And what can people do to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes? What actually works?
You know, I think you can kind of take a bunch of different methods. The biggest is taking some general precaution. And, you know, if you are going to be outside and, you know, you're going to go hiking or do anything like that for kind of continued activity, predominantly in the kind of evening dusk period, just put on a little mosquito repellent. You know, things that contain DEET are kind of really the gold standard at this point. There are some alternatives that work very well, but it's something to be really careful as to what types of repellents are actually used. And if you want to wear kind of longer sleeves or pants, I realize it's still kind of at the end of the summer and you want to enjoy the warm weather. So that's also one alternative. And just even trying to remove any breeding sites in and around the home where, you know, if you're sitting out on your back patio, you want to try to remove any potential areas where mosquitoes might be living and breeding in your yard. And just kind of tipping over any buckets or, you know, even a bird bath or, you know, other little things that can collect water in the yard. You need to kind of maintain and check on and make sure that there aren't any mosquito populations breeding in there because they can potentially contract the virus and then potentially transmit it to you due to the proximity.
And how far do mosquitoes travel? For example, if you have mosquitoes annoying you in your backyard in the evening, does that mean they're coming from somewhere right nearby, or might they be coming from a mile away?
Yeah, well, so for the most part, and this can vary by specific mosquito species. Some can travel longer distances than others, but for the most part, mosquitoes don't travel very far. They don't go miles and miles during their lifespan, and for the most part, stay within, you know, a few hundred meters or yards of where they were originally born.
Uh-huh.
So if you kind of see some activity in and around the home, then whether it be at your house or your neighbors or just in kind of the general area, there is likely a breeding site kind of within that immediate area in which these have emerged. And now feeding on you, they can potentially lay some eggs nearby as well. So it kind of builds upon this potential problem.
Do some of these other methods work? I mean, I know people burn citronella candles. Some people kind of have homegrown repellents that they'll use to keep mosquitoes away. Do any of those work, do you think?
There's some things out there. I'm not going to be negative against everything. But, I mean, there's a lot of reports that have said that citronella candles, you know, simply don't work. If anything, it's probably more the smoke that kind of confuses their ability to kind of actually smell you. You know, I had a citronella candle out, and I was getting bit right next to it the other, you know, a couple of weeks back. And as far as these other type of, you know, repellents or methods to keep mosquitoes away, there is a lot of kind of work looking into plant essential oils, which can serve as viable repellents. But I would be a little hesitant just to kind of just go out and kind of use anything to just kind of off of the word of other people. I would kind of rely on actual something that's been tested.
Are mosquitoes attracted to humans by our smell? Is that how they find us?
Well, the primary cue is with CO2. So as we are, you know, just kind of sitting or walking around, we're exhaling CO2 as we breathe. And those plumes of CO2 that we're generating kind of go up into the air, and the mosquitoes will actually kind of catch on to this. And that's usually going to be their primary signal. And then they might fly a little bit closer to us, and then they start smelling some kind of secondary cues, like some of the components in sweat are really kind of turn on mosquitoes to say, hey, this is a human, and this is a great place to go ahead and feed. And so things like lactic acid and other components of that are found on the skin with sweat really kind of cause or attract mosquitoes to bite.
And although we've been focusing on the more annoying or potentially dangerous aspects of mosquitoes, they do play an important role in ecosystems, don't they?
Well, I think the debate is still kind of out there. I think for any species, they are obviously going to have some role in an ecosystem. You know, they do serve as a food source for many other types of insects and bats and other things. But, you know, it's kind of hard to really evaluate what the actual impact of mosquitoes are in a specific ecosystem.
What I hear you saying is that although mosquitoes can be annoying, they can be vectors for disease, it's not something that is that prevalent, and so maybe we shouldn't be as alarmed or concerned about it as people might be?
Well, I don't want to quite say that. I mean, mosquitoes are definitely around, and frankly, they're not going to be going away. They've been around for a very long time and feeding on humans, and they've been very successful in doing that. And others that don't feed on humans necessarily are very successful in doing that. But, you know, I think especially at this time of the year, I think it is kind of wise to take some precautions with West Nile, because, I mean, it can be a very deadly disease, as we've seen already this year. And even in those cases in which it doesn't result in death, can actually have some long-term effects. But I think that, you know, for the most part, I don't know if I would have the kind of fear of West Nile go out and change your you know, way of life or anything like that. But I think it is worthwhile to still take some general precautions.
How much longer will mosquito season last?
Sure. Well, usually the West Nile virus transmission season typically really kind of comes to an end here once October rolls around. So we still have about another 8 weeks or so of potential activity, and these are going to be the peak periods of the season. So again, you know, if you haven't been so good so far this summer, I would definitely take some precautions coming up over the next month or so, as the number of potential cases will be out there and increase. And other than that, just try to avoid those mosquito bites and kind of save you the spare of itching them.
Any suggestions on what to do if you do get a mosquito bite, how to treat it to reduce the itchiness or annoyance?
Well, I don't know
it.
If I'm the best to speak on that. I actually have all sorts of pretty terrible allergic reactions to them.
Some people react differently.
Some people definitely react differently. I actually am forced to take Benadryl sometimes just because it gets to be so bad. But usually just kind of hydrocortisone cream or anything like that that's going to kind of reduce the itching. You want to try not to itch it because it'll actually cause the swelling to spread. So try to avoid scratching them. It can also cause like infections and so on and so forth too. So, but just kind of general hydrocortisone should work pretty well to kind of curb some of those itching.
Did you know that you had that reaction to mosquito bites when you chose to go into this field?
I've been doing this for, you know, over 15 years now, and it still doesn't get any better.
But it's worth it.
Well, it's still something that I enjoy, and I think definitely is worth from the kind of public health perspective as well.
It's important work. Well, thank you very much. We're all much better informed about mosquitoes and the possible diseases they can transmit. That was Dr. Ryan Smith from the Entomology Department at ISU. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And we also heard This Must Be the Place by The Talking Heads. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.